now we welcome Gary. We've been anticipating this, and big welcome to the UCR.
Yeah, we've been, she said we've been anticipating this because I was originally scheduled in January, but snow got in the way. So one never knows where inspiration for a service will come from. I was at the Visionary Arts Museum in Baltimore, a highly recommended spot with art from self-taught individuals demonstrating their own personal visions. And I came across a set of seven weavings, each with one of these seven statements on it. Wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, science without humanity, commerce without morality, politics without principle, and worship without sacrifice. Now those were distinctly intriguing statements, and the placard next to the weavings added to the intrigue. According to the sign, these statements are Mahatma Gandhi's seven social sins. Well, I'd never heard of it before, and I went off and did some research, and more recent research, it turns out that Gandhi published this list almost offhandedly in 1925, saying that a fair friend had given him the list. The list itself was originally given during a sermon by Anglican priest Frederick Lewis Donaldson in March 20, 1925. And I don't know whether that was the fair friend or somebody who had been at that, that sermon had taken the list down and passed it on to Gandhi. And all that Gandhi said about the list was this, quote, "Naturally, the friend does not want the readers to know these things merely through the intellect, but to know them through the heart so as to avoid them." That's the entire Gandhi commentary on the list. But there is one more connection to Gandhi. He gave this same list, copied by his own hand, to his grandson the day before he was assassinated. And since then, that list has been referenced in many other publications, including by Stephen Covey and many, many others. So with no more guidance from Gandhi, I took those seven rules as kind of a Christian might, a series of biblical passages. They're short and incomplete, and one must work to understand the meaning underlying the words. To, as Gandhi put it, know these things not merely through the intellect, but to know them through the heart. It becomes a centering exercise, a time of exploration. So I'll briefly give my thoughts, and hopefully we'll have time for discussion at the end. Let's begin with the first, wealth without works. I'm already tempted to tweak it a little bit and talk about wealth without works, plural. Some people are blessed with great wealth, either by their own doing or by their progenitors. There's nothing wrong with that. The social sin is to wallow in wealth, not using wealth to do good works. We have all heard the stories of children of those with great wealth either falling under the spell of alcohol and drugs or simply wasting their lives of privilege. I think that those who are well off should feel it incumbent upon themselves to put that wealth to work, helping those who are not so materially blessed. It is better for the world at large, and most likely it's better for those with wealth as well. Now, it's entirely possible that Gandhi would have taken a more severe tone, suggesting that anyone with wealth thrust upon them should give that wealth away and continue to work, that only wealth earned by one's own hands is worthy, otherwise it is a burden. But I'm gratified by the examples of some of the uber-wealthy, such as Warren Buffett, who said it is essential that other wealthy people invest in the world around them. And Bill and Melinda Gates started a major foundation to solve world health problems. So for me, I summarize the first one as, doing work is good, doing good works is better. Now, I found the second social sin, pleasure without conscience, to be the easiest to comprehend. It's worth noting that Gandhi was a Hindu, not a Buddhist, And a Buddhist might have trouble with the concept of pleasure in any context, because pleasure attaches one to this world and inevitably leads to suffering. A Buddhist might wish to rise above pleasure. But in our context, and I suspect in Gandhi's, the statement suggests that pleasure is not wrong in and of itself. Instead, it is pleasure derived without conscience, without recognizing the implications on self and others. That is the social sin. For many years, I taught the Unitarian Universalist Our Whole Lives class to the 7th and 8th graders at my congregation. Many think of this as the sex class. And that's certainly one aspect of the curriculum. But in fact, we spend at least as much time talking about decision making and relationships and consequences. This important curriculum develops the students' access to their conscience at a time in their lives when hormones are raging. OW is one way that UUs help people avoid the social sin of pleasure without conscience or consequence. I've taken a break from teaching this important curriculum, but I'm happy to report that the family commitment to OW has not. My wife is right now teaching OW up at our congregation, and my son Daniel joined the San Francisco UU Church and is teaching OW there, a second generation OW teacher. I struggled for quite a while with the third social sin, knowledge without character. At first, I wasn't clear what the connection was between knowledge and character, but the veil slowly lifted. Education. Our educational system emphasizes knowledge and de-emphasizes character. Never heard it suggested, but one of the flaws with teach to the test is that nowhere in the test is character evaluated. So nowhere are teachers rewarded for instilling character in the students. And knowledge without character is a dangerous thing. For we've seen it play out, for example, in Flint, Michigan, with the water crisis, where some of those involved were well aware that there was a problem with lead in the water, but did not show the character necessary to publicize the problem and force a change. My congregation emphasizes the importance of applying knowledge with character to effect change in the following manner. When our coming-of-age class graduates, we leave them with the charge, speak truth to power. We want them to understand the responsibility that comes with knowledge. And many of these social sins overlap in a variety of ways, and we'll see the issue of character playing out again and again as we continue our way through the list. Continue, for example, commerce without morality. Now, my first thought was Bernie Madoff, right? A man who made billions by bilking his investors, and some of whom were his friends and family. But in discussions with others, I realized that I had to broaden the scope of this one a bit. Because Unitarians tend to believe that morality is relative, that one person's moral may not be another. And a good example of that in the field of commerce has to do with trade. People of good conscience and good morals can fall on either side of the debate. Pro-trade advocates will point out that these deals help the desperately poor around the world, that increasing trade helps all, a rising tide raises all boats. Just as valid are those against trade, knowing that the deals cause severe disruption to industries in this country, while rarely giving workers in the other countries the economic or environmental protections we take for granted in the U.S. That those who gain in this country and overseas are generally the rich and not the poor. That a boat will not rise with the tide if the systems in place have poked holes in the ship, holes caused by economic inequality. Science without humanity was another easy one for me. I consider this to be the Jurassic Park syndrome. Two lines from that movie. John Hammond says, "I don't think you're giving us due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody has ever done before." And Dr. Ian Malcolm, Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. This is the problem, applying science without considering humanity. As was recently in the news, a scientist in China has claimed he edited the genes of embryos and babies were born with these edited genes. No one knows the impact of applying these new genetic techniques to humans, but almost all agree that it's too early to open that particular Pandora's box. And in case you think this is just some obscure claim from China, the University of Pennsylvania recently received approval to start using CRISPR to edit people's genes for the purported good of curing disease. But again, no one really knows the long-term effects. Forgetting the human element and just seeing what we can accomplish, that way lies grave and great danger. Now, I think in the 21st century, we should edit Gandhi a little bit here and talk about science and technology without humanity. Technology is invariably ahead of the moral and philosophical bulwarks needed to discern appropriate application. And our capitalist society rewards those who boldly go forward, not those who carefully consider the risks. I recently read the book titled Weapons of Math Destruction, which describes how big data tools lead to more inequality and can intentionally or unintentionally cause racial and gender bias. We have all seen the dangerous role technology played in undermining our democracy in the 2016 election, which neatly leads into the next social sin, politics without principle. I've got to say, this one is a rabbit hole that I'm a little nervous to go down. But obviously those who wield political problem without principle are a serious danger to our democracy, a Machiavellian force that we should all recognize, but one, as we have seen played out, can be very compelling to a subset of the electorate. But there's another aspect of this I think is worth considering. Practicing politics with principle can also go overboard. Politics with too much principle is dangerous as well. Yes, it's good to have principles, but it's equally important to recognize that not everyone agrees with each other's principles, and politics is the art of the possible. We have seen that extremism in the guise of upholding principles leads to divisive deadlock. If there is one long-term trend in our national body politic, it is the dismantling of the political middle. The moderate Republicans, the Reagan Democrats, the dealmakers have all disappeared. I refer you to the This American Life podcast titled Before Things Went to Hell, which includes a fascinating article on Congresswoman Barbara Jordan's 1990s failed attempt to modernize U.S. immigration policy by finding difficult compromises. What we have been left with are politicians so hardened in political principle that simply nothing gets done, even when the bulk of the American populace believes that progress should be made, for instance, on gun control. Now, the worst recent example of politics without principle that I have seen is the passing of the so-called voter ID laws. These laws claim to solve a non-existent problem, that of illegal voting, by creating barriers to access to the polling place, barriers that disproportionately impact minorities and the poor. Before the 2016 election, a county in Georgia attempted to close 7 of 9 predominantly black polling places. Fortunately, public outcry made them back off. Now we all, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, we all believe in the democratic process and the right to assert that process through voting. It is embedded in the American fabric and even in the Unitarian Universalist principles. So when politicians attempt to disenfranchise their own citizens through unnecessary laws, well, that is unpatriotic and un-American, plain and simple. It is a social sin. The point is that politics without principle becomes a blood sport about winning rather than about doing what is good for the people. Our elected officials in our congregations, in our cities, in our states, and nationally have a responsibility to the people they represent, all the people they represent, to apply their principles to their politics in a manner that leads to effective governing. So the last one, worship without sacrifice, is particularly fitting for this venue. One of my employees is a Muslim, so he observes the month of Ramadan. During Ramadan, most Muslims do not eat or drink between sunup and sundown. Now that is worship with sacrifice. Even our Catholic friends who participate in Lenten tradition don't hold a candle to Islamic Ramadan. But what does it mean to you use to say that it is a social sin to worship without sacrifice? Now, it's obviously a sacrifice for you all to come here on Sunday morning, and I appreciate it. But I think the idea goes much deeper than that. Gandhi said, quote, "Fearlessness is the first requisite of spirituality. Cowards can never be moral," unquote. And he also said, quote, "To believe in something and not to live it is dishonest," unquote. So I believe that the true sacrifice of worship does not happen here in this room. It happens out there when we go out into the world. How do we treat others, especially those we disagree with? How do we spend our money and our time? What causes do we support, directly or indirectly? How and when do we speak truth to power? These are the forms of sacrifice that I seek in a Unitarian Universalist context. It might be easier to refuse to engage with those we disagree with. It might be easier to ignore the behaviors of those who we give our money to, be it companies or governments. It might be less of a hassle to let politicians speak tomfoolery without our response. But the UU way of sacrifice is through engagement. Engagement is not without risk. Engagement is not without cost. Engagement is not easy. But living our UU values fully is how we avoid the social sin of worship without sacrifice. So those are my thoughts on Gandhi's seven social sins. I'd really like to hear yours.